Please remember, the views and opinions expressed by this show or any other show on DV Radio and its guests are strictly those of said individuals and do not reflect those of the DV Radio staff, nor the staff of Dysfunctional Veterans.
Welcome to the Service Dog Show. I'm your host, Joaquin Watai, also known as PTS Dog.
And I'm your host, Scav.
I want to let the audience know, you know, Scav and I, we've worked together. We share information back and forth.
I run Scout as my service dog. He's a hearing dog, PTSD dog.
We're here to bring you news, interviews, and information about service dogs and about matters that are of interest to the service dog community.
Thank you for joining us on the Service Dog Show on DV Radio, WDVR.
And welcome to the Service Dog Show. I'm your host, Joaquin Watai, also known as PTS Dog. And with me is Scav, who's not talking.
No, I'm not talking yet.
All right. We're very excited this evening, folks, to have an extremely special guest. I'd like to introduce you to director Josh Aronson, who is premiering the movie To Be of Service. Josh, welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
Josh, tell us a little bit about the movie, please.
Well, the film is called To Be of Service, as you said. And of course, that's a double meaning because it's about the service of our veterans who choose to go into the armed services. It's no longer a volunteer army. So it is a choice to do this. So these are extraordinary people to start with. And then at the end, when they come home, many of them who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, the lucky ones end up getting a service dog. And so it's the service of the dog. So that's the idea of the title. And it's about many things. On one level, the film is really about these vets who have PTSD, the invisible injury of post-traumatic stress disorder, which comes from experiencing trauma at a very profound level, which often happens in combat, as we know. Mm-hmm. And it's about their experiences coming home. And I was really committed to showing what PTSD is in reality for the individual who has it, for the families who have to live with it, for the children of fathers coming home who struggle with it. It's a visceral, it's a real, tactile, honest look at what that is. And so it's about that and about the treatments that get them to a place where they're often frustrated by traditional therapy and by the amounts of medication that often the VA prescribes. We go into that a bit. Mm-hmm. And then the men and women who hear about it or who are lucky enough to be able to do it, they get a service dog. And what's remarkable, almost miraculous, is how quickly their lives improve with a service dog in their life. And we all know that service dogs do all kinds of commands. They'll do things for you. They'll pick things up for you. They'll go get your meds. They'll remind you of your medications. If you're disabled, they can open a refrigerator and close a dryer door. They do a lot of things like that. Mm-hmm. They also will wake you up from nightmares. They'll warn you if you're having a flashback. Those are extraordinary things. But what I found consistently, that the difference that dogs make in the lives of these veterans is the relationship. It's the profound, unconditional love that dogs feel for their handlers, for the owners. And that unconditional love is something that is huge to these vets. Therein is a large story because they often come home with shame, with guilt, and there are deep stories to describe why that is, and we can go into it if you guys would like to. But they have such self-loathing in many cases because of the things that they remember that they did in Iraq or Afghanistan mostly, the things that they were commanded to do that looking back, they wish they had not done or wish they had not been commanded to do it. And so when they're with a dog, the dog loves them no matter what, no matter if they're enraged, no matter if they're angry, no matter if they're crying, if they have nightmares, the dog will consistently love them unconditionally. And that remarkably opens a door because pretty soon those vets will bond with that dog and start to love that dog back. Take responsibility for the dog. He has to go out and pee, so he has to take him out. Well, these are often men and women who have been shut-ins for years in some cases. They never leave because they're so frightened of flashbacks. They're so frightened of their own rages, the things that we've come to learn in the film that often accompany severe post-traumatic stress disorder. But if they have to take their dog out, if they have to feed the dog, they have to groom the dog, it gives them a responsibility outside of themselves with a creature that adores them, that loves them unconditionally. But what happens is the doorway opens slowly but clearly, to feeling again. And what I mean by that is part of the experience of post-traumatic stress disorder is that veterans can no longer feel. They can't love. It's just the third tier of trauma, which is fight, flight, freeze. This is well known. Mm-hmm. A woman gets raped, she tries to fight, she tries to run. If she can't do that, she freezes. If someone has the experience of a profound trauma, you try to get out of it, you run away from something, you try to push against it, you can't, you freeze. What happens at the end when they come home, the freeze is an emotional freeze. They report that they can't feel. Mm-hmm. There, one character in the film reports that post-traumatic stress disorder is like being under a lake of ice, under a foot of ice, and you can't get through. And no matter what you do, you bang against it. The horror is that you see your family on the other side of the ice and you can't get through. That's this very moving description of what it feels like to him. Well, with the dog, they start to feel again because of the unconditional love of the dog. And my image of that is it's a doorway opening so that they can start to feel for their family. They can start to feel for their children. They can start to love again. And it's a pathway back.
Yeah.
And so that's the through line of the film. We meet a couple of vets before they get their dog. When they get their dog, we go with them and we watch the training a little bit and we see the graduation. And then I follow in one case for a year to see the improvement in their lives. And everyone reports tremendous improvement in their lives in many, many ways.
And I have to tell you, I'm not sure if you're aware or not, both Scav and I handle PTSD service dogs. So we're very familiar. It's like you're preaching to the choir right now. We understand exactly what you're talking about. I'm curious, you've done movies, documentaries with concerning people with disabilities in the past. What led you to choose PTSD and even more specifically service dogs for PTSD?
Right. Well, there's a friend of mine is a screenwriter in Los Angeles. Her name is Julie Sayers. And she talked to me about this subject about 5-6 years ago. And she came to me. She's a dog person. She has a wonderful relationship with her German Shepherd. And she happens to teach veterans screenwriting. She's a professor at USC in the screenwriting department, in the film department. And she teaches vets. And she saw how powerful service dogs were for vets with PTSD. So she pitched me the idea of doing this film about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. At that time, I had just come off of a very large-scale documentary. It was an historical documentary. And I was really in no place to take on another film like that, that was going to be that big an emotional investment. And I was doing some personal work. My mother had died as it happened. And I was coming to terms with that because my dad died about 8 years ago. So my mom died 5-6 years ago. And so just in the natural course of things, you look at who you are and you look at your past. And I actually, after I turned her down, I went through a period of time where I started to recognize what trauma was. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of reading about it. And the reason I did is because early in my life, I had some trauma myself. Nothing like PTSD. It was more family trauma. It was individuals and what felt like mild abuse, not sexual abuse. It was just emotional abuse that happened in my family. I never thought of it as trauma before, but I came to realize it was. And from that and reading, I realized that everyone has some level of trauma. whether it's rape, whether it's combat trauma, whether it's an accident that you witnessed, whether it's sexual abuse, whether it's an alcoholic parent, whether it's simply being in a terrible accident, children being bullied in a playground consistently, all these things can lead to trauma. They don't all lead to post-traumatic stress disorder, but they're all trauma. And each of us has to overcome our trauma in some way, or we have to deal with it in some way, so that you can function as an adult or as a teenager first and then an adult. And if you don't do the work to learn to function with the trauma that you had, there's going to be a price to pay. There's going to be a price in your relationships. There's going to be a price in the way you feel in the world, with your bosses, with your spouses. So I realized how important that was. Julie came back to me about 3 years ago with the same project and really pushed me. And by then I realized how important the story of trauma was. And I realized that the story as she described it was a universal story, because just as I had dealt with my trauma, and everyone has dealt with theirs in their own way, whether it's therapy, whether it's meditation, whether it's just being peaceful, diet, whatever it is, you have to deal with your trauma. Well, these are vets with severe trauma who are trying many things, and they end up in our film with a service dog that's very effective. So I saw a way to make this film universal, not just about veterans with PTSD and their families, but about all of us. So I signed on. I thought it was something that I could bring a lot to. Mm-hmm. And that's how I came to this story.
You know, I was curious when Joaquin told me you contacted us about this, and I researched you to see what films you had done, and you follow these people for a good long while.
Yeah.
One movie, you followed those guys for about 7 years.
Yes, I did.
So when I saw this cast of characters, and you know, you've got a wide selection of veterans here, mm-hmm. you know, from all over the place. So when you just said you followed them for about a year, it didn't surprise me. So I'm glad you're doing the research, and I'm glad you're not just, you know, some cat out there just, you know, writing another story or some BS documentary.
Well, thank you. I hope it's anything but that. You know, people always ask me after I do these films and I take them around to festivals and screenings, one of the questions I get is, how did making that particular film change you? Or what did you learn? And I usually have some nice answer that, you know, touches on some truth. But, you know, I was with a group of dog lovers, an organization called Dogtopia had me to their conference. It's a dog kennel organization that boards dogs all over the country, very large, wonderful organization. And there are 300 people there from across the country. And someone in the back put up their hand and said and asked me that question. And, you know, it went right into me, because I realized how much this one had changed me because of the trauma aspect and because of going into the world of veterans who were warriors. Mm-hmm. And I'd never had that experience in my life. I'm not a veteran. I wasn't in the military, and I really didn't know many people who'd been in the military. So I had little experience with it. But spending a year and a half first researching and then filming these people across the country, and as you say, there's a whole variety of them, Marines and Army people and Special Forces people and men, women, just people who were deployed, people who were not deployed. You know, one woman in the film never left America, but she had her real dose of trauma. Right here, someone else had an accident that left him in a wheelchair and married a woman who has PTSD from being in Iraq. So a lot of different kinds, Hispanics, African-Americans, whites, a real cross-section. I'll tell you something, I learned about warriors and what warriors are and what that means and the history going back with what first responders and warriors mean in society. And when we send them off to do these things, and they come home, if we don't take care of them, if we don't honor them, we have the situation that we have now, which is 500,000 vets with PTSD who are not being properly taken care of by the VA, which is underfunded and which is not well managed. And it's a terrible situation. And as a society, we're not honoring our vets. We're not welcoming them home the way that veterans and warriors have been welcomed home for thousands of years. If you do the reading back to the Greeks, you know, you read the Iliad, the way the warriors were taken care of. The Lakota Indians are mentioned in the film, in the rituals as the warriors would come home. You know, in World War II, we did it pretty well. Aside from ticker tape parades, they all had 2 weeks on the boat coming back from Europe, and they could sit in circles, and they could talk, and they could detox, and they could tell stories, and they had senior officers there. So there was a way to let go. What we do now is they pluck them off the battlefield, and they'll say, okay, kid, your time's up, and they're home in 18 hours.
Right.
18 hours. It's impossible to imagine coming out of combat in Iraq and finding yourself dropped off and said, get over it, kid, you're home now. Welcome. Nice.
It's no joke. They FedExed me home. I got on a FedEx plane, and 18 and a half hours later, I was in the U.S.
Yeah. I heard that story, and often very bad outcomes. I'm sure you could relate. So, you know, these people that I was with, it was eye-opening who they are and, you know, how important they are to have in our society. When you've lived with trauma and you've come to deal with it, whether it's with a dog or other ways, and you're functioning, as one of our characters says at the end, I'm a healer now. I went through this, and I'm a bigger person with bigger footprints, and they're elder warriors. We've always had elder warriors, and they're important for us. They show us the way. They teach us. They have honor. And it was humbling to be with them. It was humbling to be part of it. And I just have these relationships now that I'm sure I'll have for life with many of these men and women. It's just an honor.
I think it's important to recognize that something you picked up on is the warrior ethos, I guess you would say. And you also said something else. I think it's important that we remind the audience is that PTSD is not just a veteran condition. It is a human condition.
Yes.
Veterans and first responders get exposures that can be a little bit more extreme and certainly a lot more in frequency than most people. However, anybody can get PTSD. And I'm always real careful to try and make sure that we acknowledge that it's not just a veteran condition, but if you really want to see it in focus, the best place to find it is the veteran community and the first responder community.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The first responder, one of my characters who actually, he didn't end up in the film as a major character, but he was both a veteran and a first responder because he was in the police force as a special, it was the highway patrol when he came back. And he thinks his PTSD is as much because of his experience as a highway patrolman, first responder. There was just too many accidents, too many wives he had to hold as they wept because their husband had just been killed and she was driving, too many children killed in the back seats of cars. Yeah. And he developed PTSD on top of his military experiences. So he was a mess. He was just a mess. So. Yeah. You know, you're right. It can happen. I mean, women being raped, we report. I read recently the predisposition to get PTSD is more likely in a woman than a man. Hmm. They don't know quite why, but sexual trauma is one reason. And there's a lot of women coming out of the military with MST, which is military sexual trauma, perpetrated by our own side. You know, by sexual harassment in the military is a huge problem.
Oh, yeah.
Both harassment and, of course, the occasional or not so occasional rape that women experience, and men. One of the characters I interviewed was raped. He was in a tank, and his tank commander raped him. Mm. It's bone chilling. The stories I heard, I'll tell you.
I was about to ask. Coming from not a military background and being exposed to the stories and the level of trauma that some of these individuals shared with you. I guess the question's twofold is, how difficult was it to gain their trust so that they would share? And what's going on in your mind when you're hearing just, I mean, some of these stories are horrific. And and especially, and I'm sure Scav will agree with me, when you hear a woman tell the story of military sexual trauma, I was a non-com. Scav was a non-com. And I know for me, that makes my blood boil. It's just absolutely unconscionable that a fellow service member would do that to another.
Right.
What was it like gaining that level of trust that they would discuss this? And then what was your response while you're hearing these bone chilling tales?
Yeah. Well, there was a woman that I interviewed. It was a 3-hour interview. And it was 3 hours because a lot of the interviews were very long interviews because it takes a while to earn trust. And even if I had spent time with them before, to get them to start to open up their hearts and share their truth, it just takes time. And my experience of it, which is my experience of doing interviews, which I've done for many, many years as a documentarian, is to be patient, to be open, to stay with the character completely, the subject that's talking to me, to stay with them utterly and completely. And essentially what I'm doing is I'm holding space for them to be able to share their story. And everybody wants to tell their story. And if they felt like I was going to hear it and I was going to give it honor and I was going to take them seriously, eventually they would open up. I've done that over the years in my films, and I've learned the process. And it's the thing that I'm most proud of in my documentary work is the ability to make people feel comfortable and at home and to feel safe with me and to trust me to be able to share those stories. And in terms of hearing this one woman in California who told me the story, and finally after 2 hours of interviews, she got into the details of what had happened. And she was raped by one man multiple times over a period of months. And she described the shame, this tremendous shame. She was 19 years old. She was working on a battleship. And the shame was that she didn't do anything about it because she knew if she opened her mouth, she'd be thrown out of the service. Because it was 30 years ago, 25 years ago. And at that time, and maybe often to this day, women that complain about rape or women that complain about sexual harassment by a superior won't be listened to and their careers will be over. And so she loved being in the military so much that she basically put up with this man's harassment and then ultimately rape multiple times. And I asked her at one point, when you look back on that 19-year-old and what that man did to you, who was 10 years older, where's your anger at him? And she let loose. She opened up. She just broke open. She said to me in a voice I will never forget, it's not anger, it's rage. And then she let loose on what she wished happened to that man, things that could never be in the film, and I won't repeat now. Because what I was seeing was a demon of rage in that woman built up over 30 years that had really condemned her to a hell of the experiences. And it felt as if this demon was coming into me, that her rage was coming into me. It pushed me back. I felt it was a force coming at me. And it was really painful. Really painful to take in that kind of hate and that kind of rage based on abuse.
When a veteran lets their demons out and you're around, that's probably one of the most scary things you'll ever see.
Yeah. Not just around, it was aimed at me. That was the thing. It was aimed right at me through her eyes, through her heart. And I felt it coming like it was some presence.
It's funny that you said that. My wife, she saw my eyes one day and she begged never to see those eyes again in her entire life.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And it's, I really like to commend you for, honestly, it's a brave thing to open yourself up to listen to these experiences. I mean, when you can get a veteran to let loose, that's major. I think many of us, hi Scav, I think many of us have, or Scout, sorry, Scout's dog in the background. I think many of us are so afraid of the collateral damage that we cause when we open up that we hang on to the demons. We stuff them down. We hide them. And I think that's part of PTSD is the avoidance, because the pain, the level of pain is so extreme. Right. I mean, if I don't know that there's any other words for it, it's extreme. The level of soul crushing angst is not describable, and you don't want to describe it. I want to ask, we've talked about trauma for almost a half an hour now. Let's flip the coin. Tell me about the progression, about the healing. And you mentioned family. You mentioned the spouses and the children. From the perspective of coming into these people's lives and taking a snapshot of it, essentially, what is the progression of the healing that you observed as they begin to work with their service dogs?
Well, remember, it's a multi-stage process. Let's back up a little bit. When you guys talk about, you know, your wife never wanted to see those eyes again, at that point, I'm going to guess you were probably drinking also. You were probably on substances. You were probably a little out of control, and you needed help to find some way to not, you know, be present with it all the time. And if that's not true of you, it's true of most.
Well, yes, it was before Scout. Definitely before Scout.
Can't say it's not true of me. It's very true.
Yeah, right. It's true because it's just too intense. So you need something. And so these men and women were, you know, drinking a lot. They were doing drugs a lot because it was the only way to avoid, you know, having it in your face. It was the only way to sleep. It was the only way to function. And so you get yourself to the VA, and the VA is probably disappointing, probably going to give you therapists that aren't there all the time. You go back to the VA and the therapist that you've gotten to know, he's not there that day, or he's 4 hours late, or they've got some fill-in person. There's no continuity. It's enraging.
The old zombie cocktail.
And then they give you the zombie cocktail, and they give you more drugs, and they give you more drugs. And I heard that from every guy. 30 meds. Right. I got to get off the meds. 17 meds. And, you mm-hmm. know, and the word zombie and zombified runs through the film. Well, here's the rub. When you're in that place and you're doing those kinds of substances, they won't give you a service dog. No one will give you a service dog because the dog is so highly trained, so valuable. They know that you're in no place that you're going to be able to take care of that dog. So the first tier of healing is you've got to get yourself to a place where you're no longer drinking and when you're no longer dependent on drugs. And that's a lot of work, and it's a lot of years for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get there, then you'll see a postcard up in the VA, or someone will mention, how about a service dog? You know, one of our guys says, what's a service dog? And they explain to him at the VA what it was. The VA won't pay for it. They won't pay for the service dog for a veteran with an invisible mental injury. They'll pay for it if you have a hearing loss or if you have a disability, a physical disability, but not for PTSD yet. Mm-hmm. We're working on that. Later part of the interview, because we're screening in Washington to try and push that through the VA, through Congress, to mandate it for the VA. So you get off your drugs, you get off booze, and someone introduces you to the idea of getting a service dog. And you find a place, and there's a couple ways to get a service dog. Shell out $30,000. Most vets coming home don't have $30,000. So they either, you know, they're begging, borrowing, stealing from family, friends. They do crowdfunders. They do everything they can to raise that money. They take a long time. So here you are ready for a dog, but you got to raise the money for the dog. The other alternative, there's a lot of fantastic dog training facilities that are funded by people who care, wealthy individuals who care about vets and love dogs and see the benefits. So there's scholarship programs, and there's a lot of them. But the demand is so high, it's a 3-year waiting list. So imagine you're at the place where you can get a dog. You're now off drugs. You're not drinking. They say, yes, you're a candidate. It's a 3-year wait. I mean, that's enough to, you know, drive you nuts if you know that a dog can really help you. When you finally get the dog, it's 2 weeks of training, because a well-trained service dog will do you nothing if you don't know how to use him, if you don't know how to operate with him. So we went and we filmed as the guys worked with their trainers, and we saw bits and pieces of different kinds of training to understand what it takes. Mm-hmm. Then the amazing thing is when you get your dog home, generally they report, and research has shown, within 3 weeks you start to see improvement in the symptoms of PTSD. 3 weeks. That's all it takes to start. Mm-hmm. And it gets better and better. And the bond builds and the habits build. And one guy who's taking his dog to the dog park, you know, he knows he's got to go every day. Instead of going for a half hour, pretty soon he finds he's there for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And you know what happens? The dog goes to play with the other dogs. So you go check up on your dog and the owners are there, and you start talking to the owners, and dog people are great, and pretty soon you feel safe around strangers, which mm-hmm. is a new thing for these guys. Mm-hmm. And that's the door opening. Pretty soon you start to feel independent because, you know, you got to take your dog out anyway, and your wife says, you know, we need such and such from the supermarket. So instead of going to the supermarket at 3 a.m, which is what they usually do to not have any interaction with anybody at all, to avoid the interaction with any strangers, they're able to go with the dog because they're protected. The dog watches out for them. They feel safe with the dog. They can rely on him. The dog will distract him enough, and they can get through that line, get what you need, and get out of there. And they're amazed that they can do that. So it's at the same time, it happens quickly. After 3 weeks, it starts to get better. But over the next few months, the improvement is vast. And that's what I saw over and over again. It's not a cure. This is really important. It's not a cure. Yeah, it's not that you get a service dog and all of a sudden you don't have PTSD. Every single one of my vets said there is no cure for it. It gives you the tools to be able to function better in life. It gives you the tools to be able to feel in your family. Mm-hmm. It gives you the tools to not be so reactive, to not let the rage out. And if it's coming out, your dog is trained to put his paws on your lap, and which is enough of a reminder that when you put your hand on his head, this is the amazing thing. When you touch a dog and look in the eyes of a dog, there's an oxytocin release in your brain. Just like a mother holding a baby, it's sort of a biological imperative so that the mother is bonded with a baby. It's the same thing. We have that same oxytocin release, which makes you feel good, but oxytocin suppresses adrenaline. So the adrenaline that's fueling that rage is calmed down. It's a remarkable thing. So it's symbiotic. I mean, the relationship with the dog and the owner is moving him towards a place of healing so that he can function better and better. It's a lifelong journey to be able to function. It's not a cure, but sure, it feels better that you have a life.
Absolutely agree. That's, you know, one of the subjects, one of the themes that I picked up in my book is that the service dog reconnects you, allows you to reconnect with the world around you. The illustration I use is before my service dog Skeeter, I wouldn't even talk about the weather. I'd run into the store, grab what I need, go straight to the cashier's register, check out, blinders on, if I could make it into the store at all. But you know, I could talk to you about my dog all day long.
Yeah.
It's a bridge. It's an invisible bridge that enables you to reconnect with your family, with strangers, with other veterans. In a lot of ways, my service dog has been for me a bridge that rebuilds the ability to connect to other people.
Congratulations. Isn't that fantastic?
Oh, it's, yeah.
It invites conversation whether you want it or not.
Yeah. There is a pendulum, and unfortunately, sometimes it swings too far.
We should actually mention that, you know, just to people listening who are enthralled by the idea. We all love dogs, and the instinct is always to run up and pet a dog when you see a stranger with a dog. Don't do it. Yep. The service dogs are working. You see a vest on a dog, he's working. He's working to make sure that his owner is watched out for, that his owner is comfortable, that his owner is not experiencing stress. When you go and pet that dog, you distract him. Don't do it.
Yep.
And if you must, you always ask the owner permission to touch the dog.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the
protocol. Talk to the handler.
Yeah.
Talk to the person.
Yeah, that's the protocol.
Yep. Talk to the person. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you can tell he spent a lot of time with service dogs.
Absolutely. Yeah. What kind of dogs do you guys have? What breed?
Go ahead, Joaquin.
Well, Skeeter is an Alaskan Malamute.
Oh, wow.
He's about 100 pounds. He is unusual, especially I live here in North Carolina, so it's pretty rare to see a Malamute. But he is also, he's an exception to the rule as far as that breed goes. Skeeter is one in a million and has saved my life multiple times. He is something else.
Yeah.
And
Great. How old is he?
He turns 9 in January. He's getting up there, and it's time for me to start thinking about his successor.
Yeah, the working life of a service dog, for those of you who don't know, if you're curious, is about 10 years.
Yeah,
right. And everyone asks me when they learn about the connection and the depth, and they see the love of after they see the film, you see the incredible love of the owner and the dog, and they say, well, what happens when they lose the dog, or if the dog dies, or when he can't work anymore? One of the vets in my film who had a dog, he got it from the Patriotic Service Dog Foundation in California, totally in love with this dog named Indy. The dog, after 4 years with him, the dog developed cancer, and he had to put him down, and it was crushing. And he's just now coming out of it. He's going to get another dog, but he hasn't been able to. And it set him back so dramatically. It was just the worst possible thing that could have happened.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah.
I don't think that, it's a subject that I bring up occasionally in my social media and in my broadcasts. It's a subject as a community service dog handlers avoid, because the connection that we have with our dogs is so... if you don't understand, you don't understand. There's no way to explain how deep a connection we build with our service dogs. And that bond is so essential for our health, mentally, physically, our well-being centers around that bond that we build with our service dogs. And it's not something that you can just go out and take one off a shelf and replace. It doesn't work that way.
No doubt.
But you can get a new service dog. I mean, there are a couple of people in the film who've had multiple service dogs. Mm-hmm. One guy, Terry, who founded with his daughter something called Paws for Vets. And it's a beautiful organization. And his wife, his daughter actually got him the first dog years ago. And it was astounding to him how powerful it was. He's a Vietnam-era guy and suffered mightily from both PTSD and moral injury, which is something, if you guys are up for it, I'd love to talk about moral injury.
Sure.
And he was on his third service dog, and he said the service dog was like the universe coming back. And he used language like that throughout the interview about how important that dog was to him. So each time, it was tragic, it was terrible, but he bucked up, he recognized how important it was, got another dog, and within a month, they started to bond, and life goes on.
Yeah, I think as I contemplate the inevitability of Skeeter's loss, I think that I've come to a place where I'm fairly resolute that life does have to go on. He's brought me an amazing distance. We would not have been having this conversation 6 or 7 years ago. No. Getting back into media after my time in service was never even a thought process 7 years ago. But here I am, with him about to turn 9, and I'm out here. Yeah. I couldn't be here. We wouldn't be having this conversation if it wasn't for Skeeter.
Fantastic.
Great. So I think that in my mind, I understand that I owe it to him to move forward when that time comes, to find a new dog, build another bond, train, and then train some more, so that I can continue the mission that he put me on.
Yeah. And also, you know, just because he retires, you can keep him as a pet, and he can be your family.
You don't know Skeeter, though. There's no pet Skeeter. Skeeter does work, period. He will probably, honestly, he will probably be right there by my side until the day he passes, simply because of his personality. There's nobody else can do it. It's his job.
Yeah.
Period. It is his job.
So how old was he when you put him to work? About a year and a half, two?
I trained him for a little more than 18 months. I actually bred him. I've had him since birth. And that's one of the wonderful things about the law is that disabled people have the right under the ADA to train their own service dogs. And we have worked and trained every day. Every day is training. Every time we go out is a training opportunity. Mm-hmm. That's something I talk a lot about is the responsibility that the handler bears when he walks into a place of business with a leash in his hand.
Yep.
It is absolutely the handler's responsibility to maintain that dog's behavior and that dog's ability. And so if you're doing it right, you never stop training. Right. And we've come to a point now where we work like a unit. We are a smooth functioning team, but it's taken years of development and maturity on both of our parts and understanding to get there. But again, you know, the puppy saved my life, but the dog gave me a mission. And part of that mission is just keeping us to get up to snuff as a team so that we fulfill the requirements of the ADA, which is, as I'm sure you're aware, that the dog is trained to perform worker tasks to assist with my disability. The dog is, not obtrusive, you know, that the dog is well-behaved and focused in public. The dog is, of course, groomed and housebroken. And I think the most important language in the law, under the control of the handler at all times.
Right.
And in order to do that, in order to fulfill that part of the requirements of the responsibilities of the law, you have to train. There's no way around it. You train and you train and you train.
Also, if you don't keep training the dog, dogs have to work. They respond to the work.
Yeah.
It's really
Well, and they grow and change and we grow and change.
Yeah, sure.
And they absolutely love what they do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the only payment they need is a good boy and a pat on the head.
Yep. I don't know if you heard earlier, but there was banging on my door of my office. That was Skeeter insisting that he be where he's supposed to be, which is on the floor right next to me, making sure I'm okay. This is his job. I mean, and he was beating on the door. I had to mute and get out of my chair and go let him in. It's like, no, you're not supposed to be there without me. It's just so you touched on it. Let's talk about it. Talk about moral injury. Is this in the film or is this a subject that we're gonna see?
It is in the film. You know, the first question you asked me was to talk about the film and describe it. Mm-hmm. And so I got a little carried away describing the linear story of the vets before and then when they get their dog and then following them for a year. Mm-hmm. And that's the linear story of the film. But woven into that story are other themes and stories that I came across in my research that I wanted to share and I wanted to weave into the film. So the reason we have so many characters is they all talk on these different subjects. Mm-hmm. And these subjects include things like, why does everybody want to go back when it's so horrific and the trauma is so dire? You'd think, you know, a civilian would think after being deployed, you'd be so happy to be home. No. Every one of the soldiers that I talked to, and I would wager you two feel the same way, if you could be deployed tomorrow, if they would let you go back tomorrow with your buds, with your unit, your battle buddies, you would be there in a heartbeat. And so we have a whole section on why that is. And that's a very, very powerful thing. It has to do with the bonding that happens of the unit from basic training and the fact that you take a bullet for each other and you're trained to do that. That's what the military thing is, and that's what being a warrior is. You're not there by yourself. Another thing is coming home, how difficult it is to come home and how our military does not take care of our guys and women and doesn't have the rituals of bringing them home. And one of the other things we talk about is moral injury. I find that most people have never heard of moral injury, and it's really come into common parlance in the last 3 or 4 years. And what moral injury is when you are told to do something, commanded to do something, or you are witness to something, and you don't do anything about it. You're 19 years old. You see something happen in your unit. You see something happen with civilians. You're forced to drive through a village, and people get killed. Civilians get killed because of you're being ordered to do it. Well, at 19, you just take command, and you take the command, and you do it. But when you get home, and you remember, and you think about all the things that you saw and all the things that you were told to do, you have such shame and such remorse about what you did that it physically hurts. And the self-loathing that comes along with those things is debilitating. That's moral injury. Hmm. When you're told or asked to do things that are at odds with what you hold sacred or what you grew up with. Yeah. And it's a huge problem. And it causes, there's 22 suicides a day among veterans. And a lot of them, I dare say, are suffering from moral injury as well as PTSD.
Very, very possible. Thank you for bringing that up. I don't know that we've ever really discussed it a lot in the community. I think it's an issue we need to look at more. Just an interesting concept I'd like to throw out to you. At any time while you're talking to these veterans, did you consider that PTSD, that the way they were coming home might even be more of an occupational hazard? I mean, these are people who are paid to go do dangerous things with around dangerous people in dangerous places. Is it's inevitable that many of them are going to come back changed?
Well, 20%, they say, I think it's 18 to 24% of vets coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan present with PTSD. Mm-hmm. The veterans who get PTSD, more likely than not, had trauma in their childhood. Mm-hmm. It's more likely that you will end up with PTSD if you experience trauma in your childhood. It's in your system. Somehow the body likes that, the brain likes that, and it feels familiar and you go there. To whether or not it's just a hazard of the job, I guess you could say we have to conclude it is a hazard of the job. Mm-hmm. What can the military do in the field to avoid it? I suppose True. There's a lot of different kind of supervision, a lot of kind of observation of people, what's happening. There's something called berserk state. Mm-hmm. Which is one stage leads to it. Berserk state was first written about in the Iliad 2,500 years ago by Homer. When Achilles' best friend Patroclus was killed, he went ballistic. He went into the state called berserk state that the army recognizes very clearly. What it is you feel invulnerable and you want revenge and you want to just go out and kill, 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 kill and get revenge. Well, I've heard this. I don't want to pretend I'm an expert, but I've heard that the Army uses that. That they will take those men who are in that state and they will send them on missions that could be described as suicide missions because mm-hmm. they know that these people have no fear and they will go into those places. And they'll do that to the point at which it's almost sheer exhaustion, the amount of time they'll let them spend, because they'll just move until they drop because of this berserk state. Well, I dare say that has to contribute to what ultimately is PTSD. And mm-hmm. it's unethical. It's horrible if that's so. So I think that there's a lot of military senior management that could be brought to bear to mitigate coming symptoms of PTSD. And it's probably going to take a lot more research and a lot more sensitive folks in the senior level of military for that to happen.
Hmm. Yeah.
But as I said, I preface this by saying, I don't pretend to be an expert on these things. This is just, I've talked to a lot of people. I've read a lot of books about all these things.
Yeah. No, I think
that's my take.
I think cultural shifts have to occur within the service if we're going to address some of the issues that we see after the service. I don't disagree with that concept at all. And I think another thing that we're missing is the military spends a lot of time training its service members to be warriors. The military does not spend any time untraining service members to be warriors.
Exactly.
And that, whether it happens while you're active duty or whether there is some new program or something that we could do at the VA to, you know, some kind of a transition, a return to civilian life type program, something, there needs to be some, like you said, you know, during World War II, they were on a ship for 2 or 3 weeks or a month sailing home, and they sat around tables with, you know, cups of coffee, and, you know, they were on a Navy ship. They weren't sailors, they were soldiers. So they sat and chewed the fat and processed and deprogrammed. And by the time we get to Vietnam, 18, 20, you know, 24 hours after you're on the battlefield, you're home.
That's right.
And don't let the door kick, you know, hit you in the ass on the way out.
Yeah. I don't think it can be the VA though. I think it has to be the military, because I think it has to happen when they transition. You can't put them on a plane and bring them home. You got to send them somewhere into retreat. I mean, when the Native Americans or African warriors from tribes or Greeks back in the day would come home from war, they were not allowed to mix in society. They were not allowed to. They had to go on retreat. They had to go on walkabouts. They had to go and do different practices that would leach the toxins of war out into the earth. You know, whatever we deem in our 2020, you know, at this time is the appropriate thing to do, we can't just put them on a plane and send them home. We need these rituals to release, to both accept, celebrate the warriors and they're coming home, and then let them release the toxins of war and bring their souls back into them. So many times you hear the language of, I lost my soul. I felt my soul flee. They have to have an opportunity to bring their souls back. I mean, that's flowery language, but that's real.
And in a combat MOS, it's balls to the wall 24/7. I mean, I went from Panama to training out in the field to Desert Storm. 30 days after Desert Storm was over and I was home, I was in Arkansas blowing stuff up. I mean, it's nonstop. I mean, you're always out there doing mission oriented tasks.
So it's too much for the human mechanism to bear without having some transition that's very thought out. You know, I mean, Tom Flood, who's an Army guy in the film from Billings, Montana, said he got a two-hour course after being in Iraq for a year, right?
Wow.
It's not enough. You know?
Yeah, no, that's not. Josh, we're coming up on our time. I'd like you to fill us in on where people will be able to see the movie. Obviously, this program is going to debut right before the premiere of the movie in New York City on the 1st of November at 7 p.m. Eastern?
There's afternoon shows.
Oh, okay.
The 7 p.m. show is where I'll be.
Okay.
One of my veterans and his dog and a lot of our team. And that's, you know, that's the fun one, because I'll introduce the film and then we'll have a Q&A afterwards.
Awesome.
And that's at the Cinema Village, which is 12 East 12th Street in Manhattan, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the 1st to the 7th of November.
Okay.
And then in Los Angeles, it opens on November the 8th, runs for 7 days. I'll be there on the 8th and the 9th at the 7 p.m. show.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have other shows that are going to be hosted by different veterans groups. There's one at 3 o'clock on Sunday, I know. I won't be at that one, but my co-producer, Julie Sayers, will. Beyond that, it's going to be at the Landmark Cinema on November the 6th in Chicago. But the easiest thing someone can do, if they wanted to see a screening of it and see what's out there, is to go to our website, which is simply tobeofservicefilm.com. tobeofservicefilm.com. And on the homepage, you'll see those two New York and LA things. If you pull down, there's a pull down menu under screenings, it'll tell you wherever it's being screened.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also tells you if you're in a veterans organization and you want to host a screening or bring the film to your community, we're all about that. That's what we want to use the film for. We want veteran families to see this film. So in any way we can make it possible for you guys to see it, to bring it to your community, we'll work with you and do anything we can to do that.
Awesome.
The film will eventually be on Netflix. They're very interested in the film. We're very happy about that. And it'll be in universities and non-theatrical situations, and it's going to roll out over the next year. And there seems to be an awful lot of interest in this, which is just heartening after 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
You can always find me. My website is on, my email is on there, or I think it's info@tobeofservice.com. It'll tell you that, and just give us your thoughts. We're on Facebook under To Be of Service, Instagram, you know, all the social media, you'll find us.
Great.
Be of service.
Yeah, we'll post all your links on the page.
Thank you.
Yeah, as and yeah, I was going to say, we'll make sure DV Radio will share it all as well when it broadcasts. Josh, I'm very, very grateful that you took the time. I know you're a busy man, and thank you so much for spending the time with us and talking to us about the movie and about your experience. If there is one thing that you would like to say to the audience, who is primarily veteran, although not all veteran, what would you like to tell them? What's the takeaway when they leave the screening of this film?
Well, I guess the takeaway is to ask for what you need, to ask loved ones, tell them your story, let them hear it in a way that they can hear it. Don't clam up. You need to communicate your story. There's people around you who love you. They'll hear it. And if they don't get mad. Calm down. Go to them and say, I need you to hear my story. This is what I did. This is who I am. And that experience is not going away. The combat experience is a one-way journey, but it's not a destructive journey. It's a journey of growth. And you can be an elder and you can have wisdom and just be calm about it. Mm-hmm. Move into it. Don't get angry. We civilians are the ones who know less. So be patient with us, just as we need to be patient with you.
I'll add to that, trust your dog. If you handle a PTSD service dog, don't forget.
Trust your dog.
Trust your dog. Thank you guys so much. You guys are great for this show.
Thanks for doing this, Josh. There's not much out there, buddy.
Yeah, we appreciate it. We appreciate the visibility that it'll bring to the disabled veteran community and the dogs that save our lives. I can't tell you how grateful I am that you undertook this project, because this is a message I've been sharing for almost 3 years now, and sometimes I feel like I'm just out standing in the woods shouting at trees. So
this one was huge.
Yeah,
this is good. This will get the word out. I think the responses to the film have been huge, and I'm just so proud of it and so honored to have done it. And it was life-changing for me, and it was. I hope it helps a lot of vets and a lot of vet families.
Yes, you betcha. Folks, you've been listening to The Service Dog Show with myself, Joaquin Watai, and my co-host, Scav, of the Scav and Scout Chronicles, and our special guest, director Josh Aronson, director of the movie To Be of Service. Look for it at tobeofservicemovie.com. Find a screening.
To be of service film.com.
Excuse me. Thank you. To be of service film.com. And hey, I love that veterans organization hosting a screening thing. I think I might put a bug in a couple of people's ears and get that information out there. That'll be pretty awesome to see happen. You have been listening to the Service Dog Show on DV Radio, WDVR. Don't forget, DV Radio is for veterans by veterans. And we do this all for you free of charge. If you can support us, check out DV Radio on Patreon. That's patreon.com/DV Radio, and see if you can help. Thank you very much for joining us on The Service Dog Show.
Thanks. Bye, guys.
DV Radio.